Accession number 26729, Reel 1.
Bob Cherry, Reel 1. Can I start by asking you where you were born and when that was?
Yep. On the 14th of September, 1921, at the King William in Enderby, Leicestershire.
And can you tell me a little bit about your background? Where did your family, what did your family do, and how many brothers and sisters did you have, and what sort of area did you grow up in?
It was varied. I moved not long after I was born, I think when I was about three. We moved from Enderby to Desford, where father took over a pub. Desford is in the middle of the mining area at that time in Leicestershire. And we were there for about 4 years, and then we went to Whetstone, where Pop took over the Bull's Head Hotel. And we were there until I joined the RAF. School was quite a happy time. No problems there. I got the biggest thrashing from my teacher that I think everybody's ever had. But that's beside the point. He joined the RAF later and I was a pilot and he was a navigator. But, yes, school was okay. I actually left school at 14 and a half. Although I'd gone to secondary school, but the local gasworks, there was a chappy, Eli Michael Frost, who owned it, and he wanted his son to take over, but he didn't want to, so approached my parents to see if I would do that for him. So they talked me out of it because I wanted to go into the RAF even then.
What drew you to the RAF?
Well, share interest. When we were living at Desford, there just happened an airfield there, and for my birthday, father said, "What would you like to do?" I said, "Fly." So they were having an air pageant at the time, and I went up there, and we booked in, and I'd had my first flight with Winifred Spooner. Now, I don't suppose you remember that lady. She was a famous aviatrix before the war, not quite as well known as Amy Mollison, but nonetheless she was a very good girl. And from then on it was there.
So when you left school at 14 and a half,
yeah,
what did you do?
Well, then I went into the gas business because that's the boss of the gasworks wanted me to go and learn the trade from top to bottom, and when it came to retirement I would take over. Which was all right for a time, but that wasn't me. I wanted to join the RAF.
And so, how long were you working at the gasworks for?
About 5 years. Would it be? 14 and a half, yes. 4 to 5 years. And what happened was Sir Lindsay Everard, the local MP, formed what was known as their Cadet Defence Force. Air Defence Cadet Force, I think it was. Or Corps. AD. And so when I read that in the paper, I went straight over to the airfield and booked in. And so I was part of the number one founder squadron of the ATC, as it is now. And went from there on. And then when the time came and the war came, I disobeyed all orders and went and signed on as a pilot. And was interviewed and accepted for pilot training.
What process did you have to go through to be accepted to become a pilot?
Well, you had to go and sign on at the recruiting office, and then I went down to Cardington for the interview to see if there was suitable material to be aircrew or even pilot.
I mean, were there medicals, were there exams, educational exams or anything like that to take?
Nope. There was just the initial medical exam when I first signed up. But that was it, and we didn't have any more medicals until actually in the RAF, as I remember.
And what year was that that you joined up?
1940. December the 14th, 1940, I was enrolled.
What happened to you on your first day when you joined the RAF?
surprised at the difference it was between the life I'd been living as a little village boy into the wide open world, all of a sudden.
In what way?
Well, it's a complete new vista for me. I mean, we did have a lovely childhood, as living in a village, but then again, you move to a place like Babbacombe, we went to for a start, and you're meeting people from all, or boys from all walks of life, something we'd never really done before.
So what happened to you when you arrived there? I mean, do you remember your reception?
Well, yeah, I mean, we were received and issued with a uniform, inoculated and immunised. I do remember that because it was over Christmas and I was sitting in front of a fire, shivering like the clapper with my greatcoat on. That was the effect of inoculation. And then, that was it. Then it was square bashing for a few weeks before marching down to Paignton, the other side of Torquay, to number 4 ITW, initial training wing.
Did you do your basic training with everybody, not just people who were destined to be aircrew?
Just aircrew.
Just aircrew.
We were obviously cadets.
And what happened to you during your initial training?
Well, how far do you mean the initial training?
Well, what did that involve?
Well, the initial training, the very one, was to say, the first few weeks were getting inculcated in the RAF ways and forms, bags of square bashing, bags of PT, a little literary work, but not very much. It was licking it into shape that they wanted to do first.
And what happened to you after that?
Well, then we went down to Paignton to number 4 ITW, where we started our serious studies to become pilots.
And again, what did that involve?
Well, it involved taking various subjects in the geography, history, mathematics, the theory of flight, meteorology, and that would be about it.
Could you describe a typical day during that period? What time did you get up?
Just trying to think. I think we were called at 7 o'clock in the morning, and it was breakfast at 8, and then on parade at 8:30. And having had the roll call, then we dispersed to our various jobs in the course of the day. And
Well, I mean, did you have classes?
Oh yes, there were proper classes. I mean, when we moved down to Paignton, all the lectures were held in a big mansion owned by a singer, the sewing man. And so that's where the school was. And on whilst we're on there, we had to do sentry duty, and I was going on duty one night about 2 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning, and there was a sudden bang as the idiot who was on sentry go at the time let his gun off by mistake. Scared the living daylights out of me, but that was it. A series of, again, we did bags of square bashing, bags of fitness tests, and by the time we graduated from there, we were fit. At least we thought we were fit.
So what stage had you reached when you left Paignton?
Oh, we just passed all theory.
And what was the next stage?
Then the next stage was going up to the north to a reception centre there to be kitted out with, as I said earlier, with tropical kit, and then boarding the SS Britannic in Scotland, and then setting sail across the Atlantic. But even then we didn't know where we were going, and it really wasn't until we reached Halifax in Nova Scotia that we realised where we were.
And what year was that?
And that was 1941, May 41.
And did you obviously discover the purpose of your trip to Nova Scotia?
Well, we knew we were going for flying trading, but we didn't know we were going down to the States, because they did have a big empire trading scheme going in Canada. But apparently Churchill had told Roosevelt we were getting so many killed, could he help? And Roosevelt supposedly rang General Arnold, who was looking after the USAF training in the southeast, down in Georgia and Florida and Alabama, and said, could he do? And he said yes. And in that short time, all that happened, and we were suddenly, shall I say, dumped in the States. And I finished up in Georgia, Albany, Georgia, where I started our training. Now, go on.
Well, tell me about the training. Were you training with the American Air Force alongside them, or were you separate from
them? Well, it was the American system. They had what they was known as upper and lower classmen. And so there were two courses going. The Americans upper class, and we were the lower class. And they ruled us with a rod of iron. Now, we'd never been used to this kind of a discipline, because they were using their system of training, which was hazing and all that went with it. And it took us quite a long time to get used to it. In fact, it took me a heck of a long time, because I didn't like that type of discipline.
Well, describe it.
Well, it was sitting down, for example, for a meal. It wasn't a question of just sitting down and picking up your knife and fork and eating. It was a question of sitting at the table with the American upper classmen. We're divided into two, and the Americans ate first, and then we had to wait to see what was left over. Then we were allowed to eat, and then we had to do what was known as a square meal, which meant putting your knife and fork there, and things like that.
Sorry, could you describe that? You made some gestures with your hands.
I would say so. It was a question of having a square meal, was using your fork, picking it up, bringing it up, and then 90 degrees into your mouth, and down again like that. And all little tricks like that. And it went all the way through the... With the beds, for example. The beds had to be made every day. The sheet had to be turned down 6 inches. They had to be tucked in under the bed at an angle of 45 degrees. Now, as far as the 6 inches was concerned, you're allowed a quarter of an inch either way. If it was outside those limits, you were given demerits. The same with a 45 degree angle. If you're more than 5 degrees out either way, you're given demerits. Well, if you got five demerits, it meant an hour's walking at the weekend. And if you got more than that, they doubled up. So if you got 6 demerits, you were 3 hours. 7 demerits, 5 hours, and so vita.
What do you mean by walking?
Marching around the parade ground. And making sure you were kept going.
So what was your training like?
Very good.
We
carried on with the... with our theory whilst we were there, and by the time we got over the States, we were capable of doing 8 words a minute, Morse code, on the Morse key, and 5 words a minute on the oldest limb. Well, the American who was instructing us on the radio side, or on the Morse code side, had the brilliant idea that if we could go to 14 words a minute, we could be excused of the week, providing on the Friday afternoon we did the test and passed it. So it wasn't long before most of us could do 14 words a minute, because it's much better sitting in or lying on your bed cooling off than in the sweaty classroom. Of course, there's no air conditioning those days. And then, as far as the flying was concerned, you flew in the morning and lectures in the afternoon, and then vice versa.
What sort of aircraft were you training on?
German PT-17, that's the primary trainer, and that's a lovely aircraft.
And could you talk a little bit about that air training?
Well, I suppose in a sense it was regimented to the point that we were taken up to fly, we were taught the elements of flying, we were taught how to take off and land, taught how to do aerobatics, and all that sort of thing. And then after about, depending on how good or bad you were sent solo. Now, all these instructors were civilians. They'd been taken on just to be instructors to take people through the primary. And I must say, they were very good. And so after about 11 hours, I soloed and then promptly put a wing in. But I got through that all right. And then went on for 12 weeks was the training. 12 weeks was the training on primary. And then after that, if we were successful, we went on to basic training. And that aircraft was a Vultee BT-13A, where we went into night flying and things like that, and formation flying. One of the things in the primary side was we had to do spot landings. In other words, there was a small area on the airfield in which you had to land to pass successfully. And I think there were three different types. There was a 90-degree side approach, the 180-degree, and the 360. And you had to pass all of them to get onto the next stage. If not, you were scrubbed. And, of course, we had these military discipline because although the instructors were civilian, the rest of the organisation was military.
Did you have any British officers with you?
There was a liaison officer, but he wasn't with us. He was a central spot, and he came down every so often to see us and talk us through. But that was about it. But then afterwards, after the 12 weeks, then the Americans left and went on to the basic, and we moved up to become upperclassmen, and then the RAF came in, who became lowerclassmen. So we took over from the Americans, but obviously we didn't give them the same type of discipline that the Americans had given us. But it was also very interesting because I would think a good 90% of the population where we were in Georgia, the only thing they knew about an Englishman, he was either the son of a lord, or the son of a boxer, or the son of a pub. They had no idea of the concept of what the Brits were like. And with typical Georgian hospitality, they gave us every single thing they could do in the way of help. So there was never a weekend whereby some of us were not invited to various parts of things. One of my pals and myself, we were invited to go to a place in South Carolina. And this couple came down in this beautiful, great big car and took us back home. And wined and dined us exceedingly well. And when we got to the bedroom, it was pure silk pyjamas and pure silk sheets and pillows, and it was absolutely spot on. And that's when we came across this, the more sophisticated American style of a bathroom, which had to be seen to be believed. And then the next day, after church, they took us up into the Adirondacks, I think it was, to show us around there to see the rattlesnakes, and then back again in time for returning back to duty at 4 o'clock on the Sunday afternoon.
So how long all in all were you in Georgia training?
Well, I stayed in Georgia all the way through because there was the primary at Dar Aerotech at Albany. There was the basic at Macon, which was still in Georgia, Cochrane Field, and then back to Turner Field at Albany to complete our training. Having passed out on the BT-13A, and had gone all through that. We then went on to Harvard. Now, when I was on the basic trainer, we were sent up to do our night flying, and I was sent solo. And the first solo I did, I lost control. But somehow, and don't ask me how, I've never found out, I came out of it. I got into what's known as a steep spiral where the aircraft tightens up. And so I just pulled back the throttle, hit the right rudder, pulled back the stick, earth and sky, straight and level. And when I landed, I was like that, shaking like an aspen leaf. But I made a beautiful landing.
So when did you leave America?
Left America in February 92, 42, February 42.
And where did you go?
Then from there we went back to Canada, to Moncton, where we were there for 2 or 3 weeks to get sorted out and get us prepared for the to going back to this country. Which I should say, when we graduated in the States, we were given American wings. And it was, as far as I know, a nationwide broadcast with the ceremony. And then, as I say, we went back to Moncton in Canada. And from there on, we went back to Halifax and picked up the Dutch ship called the Volendam, where we set sail back to the UK. And on the first night out, one of the destroyers was torpedoed. But we got back safely. That was all right. And then it was a question of going down to Bournemouth to get a bit more rehabilitation before being sent off, as I was, to Harrogate to do my GR course, which is a navigation course. So that when we graduated from there, we were fully qualified pilot navigators. And that only happened in Coastal Command.
So had you joined Coastal Command, or by then, or been allocated to Coastal Command?
I'd been allocated to Coastal Command when I went on the GR course. And then from then on, I was in it. Then we went, after completing that course, went over to Limavady in Northern Ireland to convert onto Wellingtons. And there I had my first, if bike called serious accident. We were doing some night flying, and there were 2 hours on the aircraft. And I'd done my stint, and the other bloke had taken over. And he landed and ran off the runway. Well, at that time we only had flares on the runway. And the Wellington being made of canvas sort of business, well, it caught fire. So I was up in front of the CO the next morning for burning out a Wellington. We got a severe telling off and said carry on, which was fortunate. You know, we were lucky. So we'd completed that, and when, towards the end of the course there, the idea of crew selection was simply you're all put in the room together, pilots, navigators, wireless OPAGs, and start to sort yourselves out.
Into crews.
And there was two chaps came over to me and said, could we fly with you, Bob? I said, well, yes, delighted. And I said, now, who are we going to have for a navigator? And he said, we think we know a chap who'll do it all right. So they got Tug Wilson, who came over. And so within half an hour, I got a full crew.
How different was it learning to fly Wellingtons from the previous aircraft that you flew?
Well, for one, with the other aircraft, they're only single-engined, and with the Wellington, they were twin-engined. And so you had the problem of asymmetric flying and all the rest that went with it. But they were quite nice aircraft to fly, gentlemen in a sense. Although the first ones we were flying, the engines weren't really powerful enough to fly on one engine. So if you lost one engine, you invariably had to crash land or ditch, which never happened to me, anyway.
So once you'd established your crew, what happened to you then?
Well, then we were posted to the squadron, and we were posted to number 547 Coastal Squadron at Holmesley South, where we just started. We'd only been there for about 6 weeks, and we'd only had two aircraft delivered to us. Well, those two aircraft left and went down to Chivna.
So you were a squadron without any planes?
We were a squadron without any planes until we got down to Chivna. And then there were just the two that went down there, and then when we got to Chivna, the aircraft came in. And one
so
of
you were a new squadron, in fact?
Absolute brand new, right from scratch. And then when we got there, there were just the admin staff that were there. And then, as I say, we booked in and then moved down to Chivna. And I always remember that, I think it was the time there was a propaganda film on, of which F for Freddy was a part of it. So I said to, the crew, how about having F for Freddy as our call sign? They said, well, good idea. And so I went to see the CO. We said, okay, fair enough. And then when we got to Chivna, we were doing all this formation flying for anti-shipping patrols.
I was going to say, can you explain what your function was as a member of Coastal Command?
Well, at that time, we were trained torpedo bombers. Our job was to go out sinking German ships. Nothing to do with anti-submarine work at all. And we used to do it in formation. So that's when we moved north to Tain in Scotland to get ourselves ready to torpedo the Tirpitz.
Can you just perhaps go into a bit more detail about what that involved, bombing ships involved? And you said flying formation. So could you just talk a bit more about that?
Well, yeah, you're used to flying in VICs of three. And then you had to get down to a certain level, and then when you were attacking, you had to be at a certain speed, because if you didn't do it correctly, the torpedo either went in and went straight down, or it porpoised and didn't do anything. So it was absolute exact flying. And we were helped in that a little later on by having a radio altimeter, which kept it at the right height, which was very good.
What sort of height did you have to be at?
50 feet, I think it was.
And you said the angle as well was important.
Well, it's absolute straight and level at 50 feet.
And can you describe what happened in a bit more detail? I mean, just talk me through.
Well, I mean,
bombing a ship.
We never got to that stage.
Okay.
You see, this is what happened. Having got all that training in at Chivna, then we moved north, as I think now, to be prepared to have a bash at the Tirpitz. And what happened was, I think the bomber command got in first. So that was our job finished. So we came back to Cornwall, to an airfield called Davis Stowmoor. And there we converted onto anti-submarine work. And it was then our job to go out to hunt for submarines.
When was that?
That was in 1942-43.
So you're based in Cornwall?
Whereabouts? Yeah. Davis Stowmoor, which is near to Camelford, which is near to where King Arthur was supposed to be. In Tadjil.
And can you describe what that job involved?
Well, yeah,
anti-submarine.
It was a question of getting out into a certain position in the Bay of Biscay, and we did with what were called musketry patrols, a musketeer, one of the two, and where you were what we naughtily called creeping Jesuses. What you did was to pick your point, fly in one direction for so many minutes, and then turn and go down that way, and then come back again, and then back again. And so you all forever lasting and moving forward. And you always kept half the visibility distance, so that you never lost contact with that area of the sea. And you did that for I suppose about 6 hours, five and a half, 6 hours.
Bob Cherry, Reel 2. We were talking about anti-submarine operations in the Bay of Biscay.
Yep.
Could you start from the top, as it were, and describe, one operation, an operation from scratch? Would you have information as to where submarines were, or would you just go out looking for them, for example?
Basically, just go out looking for them. The area we were covered was where the U-boats went out from France and back again. So you had these musketry patrols where we all covered the right, so nobody overlapped.
So you all had a specific
area? We all had a specific area to do, which was about 5.5 to 6 hours, because we had to fly out to that position.
And how many of you were in the air at the same time? Was it a continuous
day? Always a continuous day and night, 7 days a week. I mean, there was no arguments about it. And as far as we could, we covered as much of the Bay of Biscay that we could. I mean, we went down as far as the... what was it called? Cape. I can't remember it, but it's off the Spanish coast. And we used to stay just outside the... limits laid down, the international line. But that was done, and I say had one part, the next chap on the squadron would have another part, and then the other squad was doing it at the same time. And so basically the object of the exercise was to try and keep the U-boat underwater. Now, if you were fortunate or to meet up with the U-boat, well, we used to pick it up on radar, which at that time in the Wellington was known as ASV Mark II, which was only one of the pioneers. It wasn't all that good, but it was useful. So that you could pick up a U-boat at about 10 to 15 miles, and then we'd home in on it, and then drop down to an operational height of about 500 feet, go over the U-boat, straddling it if you could with the depth charges, so half of them felt one side and half of them felt the other. Then up and away, because your depth charges had all gone. Now at that time we were getting very good overall, I mean not just our squadron, but everybody was getting very good indeed. And the Germans started to use JU-88s. Which were one of their sort of fighter bombers, which was an extremely good aircraft. And I had the misfortune to meet up with eight of them one day, but I was fortunate enough. Our orders were that if you're attacked by these eight JU-88s, was to dump your depth charges and turn west, turn them away from their bases so they couldn't come too far. But it just so happened to the west it was clear blue skies, to the east it was cloud. So I turned east and got into cloud, and that was it. That was over and done with.
Can you describe the crew of your Wellington? How many did you have, and what were their different functions?
I had a crew of six. I had a co-pilot by the name of Jimmy Ayling. Navigator was Tug Wilson. And the... three wireless op AGs. Now the three wireless op AGs, one went into the front turret, one went into the rear turret, and one was doing the radio work. Then after a half an hour, I used to swap them around so that nobody got tired or bored with being where they were. And that was what we kept up, because looking at the ASV at that time, the navigator, that was a tiring job. So sometimes the co-pilot would take over from the navigator to look at the screen, and then sometimes I would do the same, hand over to the co-pilot and then look at the screen for about half an hour and then back on duty again.
And so everybody did gunnery work as well?
Yeah.
Who dropped the depth charges? Who was responsible?
Navigator. He guided you in. He guided you in from a height of, I think again it was about 250 feet, I think it was, and he had got his prone position in the front of the aircraft, and he'd guide you in. And it was he that actually dropped the depth charges.
And how many would you drop?
8, I think it was.
For each side?
For each side, if you could. Not yours could.
And how many submarines do you think you hit?
Me? I never saw one.
You've flown away before?
Well, no, I just didn't see them. I mean, they nothing appeared to me. But, I mean, it was only years afterwards that I realised how many crews we had lost on 547 Squadron through anti-submarine work. I was absolutely shattered.
Being shot down by German fighters?
Being shot down by German fighters and being shot down by the U-boats. Because the U-boats, they came back pretty fierce. And so that was one of those things that we found out. We lived a very cloistered life as a crew. I mean, when we first joined the squadron, we had the ground crew that looked after our aircraft. Then we had our crew. And when we weren't working,